He didn't fight back. He was resigned to his fate. He wiped his befouled foot on the fur of the largest and most aggressive one. He sat down, tugged by his clothes. Something large descended a stalagmite, jumping down onto the cave floor. He knew at once what it was. A knocker. Stocky, pot-bellied, hairy, bow-legged, at least 2 yards across the shoulders, with an even broader, ruddy beard. The knocker's approach was heralded by the ground shaking, as though not a knocker, but a shire horse was approaching. Each of the monster's calloused and wide feet were, however ridiculous it sounds, 1.5 feet long. The knocker leaned over him, and its breath smelled of vodka. The rascals distill hooch here, Geralt thought mechanically.
You hit someone smaller than you, Witcher, the knocker said, breathing his foul breath into Geralt's face. You harmed a small, gentle, innocent creature without cause. We knew you couldn't be trusted. You're aggressive. You have the instincts of a murderer. How many of our kind have you killed, you scoundrel?
He didn't deign to answer.
Oh.
The knocker breathed alcohol fumes harder.
I've dreamed of this since I was a child. Since I was a child. My dream has finally come true. Look to the left.
Like an idiot, he looked, and was punched in the teeth with a right hook so hard he saw an intense brightness. The knocker bared huge crooked teeth from the mass of his reeking beard.
I have dreamed of this since I was a child. Look to the right.
Enough.
A loud and sonorous order resounded from somewhere in the depths of the cave.
Enough of this fun and games. Let him go, please.
Geralt spat blood from his cut lip. He cleaned his boot in a small stream of water flowing down the rock. The almost Pekingese grinned at him sneeringly, but from a safe distance. The knocker also grinned, massaging its fist.
Go, Witcher, it growled. Go to him, since he summons you. I shall wait, for you will have to return this way, after all.
The cave he entered was astonishingly full of light. Through openings in the ceiling, bristling with stalactites, shone crisscrossing columns of brightness, drawing from the rocks and dripstone formations, a kaleidoscope of brilliance and colour. Furthermore, a magical ball blazing with light, amplified by reflections in the quartz on the walls, was suspended in the air. In spite of all this illumination, the end of the cave faded into the gloom, and black darkness loomed in the vista of the colonnade of stalagmites. An immense cave painting was in the process of being created on the wall, which nature had seemingly prepared for that purpose. The painter was a fair-haired elf, dressed in a paint-smudged mantle. His head seemed to be ringed by a luminous halo in the magical, natural brilliance.
"Sit down," said the elf, without resting his gaze away from the painting. He gestured to a boulder with a wave of his brush. "They didn't harm you, did they?"
"No, not really."
"You'll have to forgive them."
"Indeed, I will."
"They're a bit like children. They were awfully glad you were coming."
"I noticed."
Only then did the elf glance at him.
"Sit down," he repeated. "I shall be at your disposal shortly. I'm just finishing."
What the elf was finishing was a stylized animal, probably a bison. For the moment, only its outline was complete,
from its splendid horns to its equally magnificent tail. Geralt sat down on the boulder indicated and swore to be patient and meek to the bounds of his abilities. The elf, softly whistling through clenched teeth, dipped his brush into a bowl of paint and coloured his bison purple with swift flourishes. After a moment's thought, he painted tiger stripes on the animal's side. Geralt watched in silence. Finally, the elf took a step back, admiring the fresco which now depicted an entire hunting scene. The striped purple bison was being pursued in wild leaps by skinny human figures with bows and spears painted with careless brushstrokes.
"What's it meant to be?"
asked Geralt, unable to contain himself. The elf glanced at him in passing, sticking the clean end of the brush in his mouth.
"It is," he declared, "a prehistoric painting, executed by the primitive people who lived in this cave thousands of years ago, and who mainly lived by hunting the purple bison, which became extinct long ago. Some of the prehistoric hunters were artists, and felt a profound artistic need to immortalize what was in their hearts."
"Fascinating."
"It most certainly is," the elf agreed. "Your scholars have roamed through caves like this for ages, searching for traces of primitive man. And whenever they find something like this, they are inordinately fascinated, for it is proof that you aren't strangers in this land and in this world. Proof that your forebears have lived here for centuries, thus proof that this world belongs to their heirs. Why, every race has the right to some roots. Even your human race, whose roots should be sought in the treetops, after all. Ha, an amusing quip, don't you think? Worthy of an epigram. Are you fond of light poetry? What do you think I ought to add to the painting?"
"Draw huge erect phalluses on the primitive hunters."
"That's a thought." The elf dipped his brush in the paint. "The phallic cult was typical for primitive civilizations. It could also serve as the birth of a theory that the human race is yielding to physical degeneration. Its forebears had phalluses like clubs, but their descendants were left with ridiculous, vestigial little pricks. Thank you, Witcher."
"Don't mention it. It was somehow in my heart. The paint looks very fresh for something prehistoric."
"In 3 or 4 days, the colours will fade due to the salt exuded by the wall, and the painting will look so prehistoric you won't believe it. Your scholars will wet themselves with joy when they see it. Not one of them, I swear, will see through my deceit."
"They will."
"How is that?"
"You won't be able to resist signing your masterpiece, will you?"
The elf laughed dryly.
"Quite right. You've seen through me. Oh, fire of vanity, how difficult it is for an artist to quell you. I've already signed the cave painting, right here."
"That isn't a dragonfly."
"No, it's an ideogram denoting my name. I am Crevan Espagne ip Coyum Maha. For convenience, I use the alias Havelach, and you may also address me as such."
"I shall be sure to."
"You, though, are called Geralt of Rivia. You're a witcher. Presently, you are not, however, destroying monsters or beasts, but are busy hunting for missing girls."
"News spreads astonishingly quickly, astonishingly far, and astonishingly deep. You allegedly foresaw that I'd show up here. You can foretell the future, I gather."
"Anyone." Havelach wiped his hands on a rag, "can foretell the future. And everyone does it, for it is simple. It is no great art to foretell it. The art is in foretelling it accurately."
"An elegant deduction, worthy of an epigram. You, naturally, can prophesy accurately."
"And often. I, my dear Geralt, know much and am capable of much. Actually, my academic title, as you humans would say, indicates that. It reads in full, Aen Sivern."
"A sage. A knowing one."
"Precisely."
"And willing, I hope, to share that knowledge?"
Avalach said nothing for a moment.
Share, he finally drawled, with you. Knowledge, my dear, is a privilege, and privileges are only shared with one's equals. And why would I, an elf, a sage, a member of the elite, share anything with a descendant of a creature that appeared in the universe barely 5 million years ago, having evolved from an ape, a rat, a jackal, or some other such mammal? A creature that took around 1 million years to discover that one can execute some sort of operation with a gnawed bone using its two hairy hands, after which it shoved the bone up its rectum and shrieked for joy.
The elf fell silent, turning and fixing his gaze on his painting.
Why, indeed, he repeated, do you dare to think I would share any knowledge at all with you, human? Tell me.
Geralt wiped the rest of the shit from his boot.
Because perhaps, he replied dryly, it is inevitable.
The elf spun around.
What? He asked through clenched teeth. Is inevitable?
Perhaps.
Geralt didn't feel like raising his voice.
For the reason that a few years will pass, and people will simply take all knowledge for themselves, heedless of whether anyone wants to share it with them or not, including knowledge which you, elf and sage, cunningly conceal behind cave paintings, counting on the fact that people will not want to take pickaxes to that wall, painted with the false evidence of primitive human existence, eh? Oh, my fire of vanity!
The elf snorted, quite cheerfully.
Oh, yes, he said. It would be vanity, truly carried to stupidity, to believe you wouldn't smash something. You smash everything. But what of it? What of it, man?
I don't know. Tell me. And if you don't think it fit, I'll take myself off. Ideally, through a different exit, since your mischievous chums are waiting for me by the other one, longing to crack my ribs.
By all means.
The elf spread his arms wide in a sudden movement, and the rock wall opened with a grinding and a cracking, brutally splitting the purple bison in two.
Leave this way. Tread towards the light, metaphorically or literally. That is usually the right way.
A bit of a shame, Geralt muttered. I liked the frescoes.
You must be jesting,
the elf said after a brief silence, sounding quite astonishingly kindly and friendly.
The fresco won't be harmed. I shall close the rock with an identical charm, and not even the trace of a crack will remain. Come, I'll go out with you. I shall escort you. I've reached the conclusion that I have something to tell you and show you.
It was dark inside, but the Witcher knew right away that the cave was immense. He could tell from the temperature and air currents. The gravel they walked over was wet. Avalach conjured light in the elven fashion, simply using a gesture without uttering a spell. A glowing ball rose towards the ceiling, and the formations of rock crystal in the cave walls sparkled in a myriad of reflections and gleams. Shadows danced. The Witcher gasped involuntarily. It wasn't the first time he'd seen elven sculptures and statues, but the impression was the same each time, that the figures of elves and she-elves, frozen in mid-movement, in mid-flicker, weren't the work of a sculptor's chisel, but the result of a powerful spell, able to change living tissue into the white marble of Amel. The nearest statue depicted a she-elf, sitting with her feet tucked beneath her on a basalt slab. The she-elf was turning her head away as though alarmed by the patter of approaching steps. She was utterly naked. The white marble, polished to a milky brilliance, meant one virtually felt the warmth emanating from the statue. Avalach stopped and leaned against one of the columns, marking the way among an avenue of statues.
"You have seen through me for a second time, Geralt," he said softly. "Yes. You were right. The bison cave painting was camouflage, intended to discourage hacking and drilling through the wall, intended to defend everything in here from plunder and devastation. Every race, the elven too, has a right to its roots. What you see here are our roots. Tread carefully, please. It is essentially a graveyard.
The reflections of light dancing over the rock crystals drew further details from the gloom. Beyond the avenue of statues could be seen colonnades, stairways, amphitheatrical galleries, arcades and peristyles. Everything made of white marble.
I want it,
Avalach continued, stopping and indicating with a hand,
to survive. Even when we depart, when this whole continent and this whole world ends up under a mile-thick layer of ice and snow, Tir na bea arain will endure. We shall leave this place, but one day we shall return, we elves. We are promised this by Ein Ithlina Spiat, the Ithlina Aigli ap Ivienen prophecy.
Do you really believe in it? In that prophecy? Does your fatalism really run so deep?
Everything.
The elf looked not at him, but at the marble columns, covered with reliefs as delicate as cobwebs,
has been foreseen and prophesied.
Your arrival on the continent, the war, the shedding of elven and human blood, the rise of your race, your decadence, the battle between the rulers of the north and the south, and the king of the south shall rise up against the kings of the north and overrun their lands like a flood. They will be crushed and their nations devastated. And so shall begin the extinction of the world.
Do you recall Aislinna's text, Witcher? Who is far shall die at once. Who is near shall fall from the sword. Who hides shall die of hunger. Who survives shall perish from the frost. For Tedh Daireath, the time of the end, the time of the sword and the battle axe, the time of contempt, the time of the white cold and the wolfish snowstorm shall come.
Poetry.
Do you prefer it less poetic?
As a result of a change in the angle of the sun's rays, the margin of permafrost will shift significantly. Then the mountains will be crushed and pushed back southwards by the ice sliding from the north.
Everything will be buried under snow, under a thick layer more than a mile deep, and it will become very, very cold.
We'll wear warm breeches,
Geralt said without emotion.
Sheepskins and fur hats.
You took the words right out of my mouth,
the elf agreed calmly.
And you'll survive in those hats and breeches, in order to return one day, dig holes, and poke around in these caves to wreck and plunder. Athena's prophecy doesn't say so, but I know it. It's impossible to utterly destroy humans and cockroaches. At least one pair always remains. As far as we elves are concerned, Athena is more explicit. Only those who follow the swallow will survive. The swallow, the symbol of spring, is the savior. The one who will open the forbidden door, signal the way of salvation, and make possible the world's rebirth. The swallow, the child of the elder blood.
You mean Ciri? Geralt burst out. Or Ciri's child? How? And why?
Avalach seemed not to hear.
The swallow of the elder blood,
he said again.
From her blood. Come and look.
The statue Avalach pointed at stood out even among the other astoundingly realistic statues, most captured mid-movement or mid-gesture. The white marble she-elf reclining on the slab gave the impression that, having been awoken, she was about to sit up and get to her feet. Her face was turned towards the empty place by her side, and her raised hand seemed to be touching something invisible. there was an expression of calm happiness on the she-elf's face. It was a long time before Avalach broke the silence.
"That is Lara Doran ap Shiadal. It's not a grave, naturally, but a cenotaph. Does the statue's position surprise you? Support was not gained for the plan to carve both of the legendary lovers in marble, Lara and Cregennan of Lod. Cregennan was a man. It would be sacrilege to waste Amel marble on a statue of him. It would be blasphemy to erect a statue of a man here, in Tir na Be Araina. On the other hand, it would be an even greater crime to deliberately destroy the memory of this emotion. So, a happy medium was found. Formally, Cregennan is not here. And yet, he is. In Lara's aspect and pose, the lovers are together. Nothing was able to separate them. Neither death nor oblivion, nor hatred." It seemed to the Witcher that the elf's indifferent voice had changed for a moment. But that would have been impossible. Avalach approached the statue and stroked the marble arm with a cautious, gentle movement. Then he turned around, and the usual, slightly sneering smile reappeared on his angular face. "Do you know, Witcher, what the greatest snag of longevity is?"
"No."
"Sex."
"What?"
"You heard right. Sex. After almost 100 years, it becomes boring. There is nothing in it to fascinate or excite any longer. Nothing that has the exciting appeal of novelty. It has all been done already. In this or that way, but it has happened. And then suddenly comes the conjunction of the spheres, and you, people, appear here. Human survivors come from another world, from your former world, which you managed utterly to destroy with your still hirsute hands, barely 5 million years after evolving as a species. There's only a handful of you. Your life expectancy is ridiculously low, so your survival depends on the pace of reproduction. Thus, unbridled lust never leaves you. Sex totally governs you. It's a drive more powerful even than the survival instinct. To die? Why not, if one can fuck around beforehand? That is your entire philosophy."
Geralt didn't interrupt or comment, although he felt a strong desire to.
"And what suddenly happens?" Avalach continued. "Elves, bored by she-elves, court the always willing human females. Bored she-elves give themselves out of perverse curiosity to human males, always full of vigor and verve. And something happens that no one can explain. She-elves, who normally ovulate once every 10 or 20 years when copulating with a man, begin to ovulate with each powerful orgasm. Some hidden hormone or combination of hormones became active. She-elves certainly understand they can, in practice, only have children with humans. So, owing to the she-elves, we didn't exterminate you when we were still the more powerful race. And later, you were more powerful and began to exterminate us. But you still had allies in the she-elves, for they were the advocates of coexistence and cooperation. And they didn't want to admit that essentially it was about commingling."
"What does that—"
Geralt cleared his throat.
"Have to do with me?"
"With you? Absolutely nothing. But with Ciri, a great deal. For Ciri is a descendant of Lara Doran ap Shiadal, and Lara Doran was an advocate of coexistence with humans. Chiefly with one human. Cregennan of Lod, a human sorcerer. Lara Doran coexisted with Cregennan often and effectively. To put it more simply, she became pregnant."
The Witcher kept silent this time, too.
The snag was that Lara Doran wasn't an ordinary she-elf. She was genetic potential, especially prepared, the result of many years' work, in combination with another charge, an elven one, naturally. She was meant to bear an even more special child. Engaging with the seed of a man, she ruined that chance, wasted hundreds of years planning and preparation. At least, so it was thought at the time. No one supposed that the crossbreed begat by Cregennan could inherit anything positive from its pure blood mother. No, such a misalliance could not bring any good.
For which reason, Geralt interjected, he was severely punished.
Not the way you think. Avalach glanced at him. Although the relationship between Lara Doran and Cregennan caused incalculable damage to the elves, and it could have turned out well for humans, it was, however, humans and not elves who murdered Cregennan. Humans and not elves brought Lara to ruin. Thus it was, despite the fact that many elves had reason to hate the lovers. Personally, too.
For the second time, the slight change in the elf's voice puzzled Geralt.
One way or another, Avalach continued, the peaceful coexistence burst like a soap bubble, and the races went for each other's throats. A war began, which endures until today, and meanwhile, Lara's genetic material exists, as you've probably guessed, and has even developed. Unfortunately, it mutated. Yes, yes. Your Ciri is a mutant.
This time again, the elf didn't wait for a comment.
Of course, the sorcerers had a hand in this, cleverly combining breeding individuals into pairs, but it got out of control. Few can guess how Lara Doran's genetic material regenerated so powerfully in Ciri, what the trigger was. I think it is known by Vildefortz, the one who gave you a hiding on Thanith. The sorcerers who experimented with Lara and Rhiannon's progeny, running a veritable breeding farm, didn't get the expected results, so they became bored and abandoned the experiment. But the experiment continued. Just spontaneously. Ciri, the daughter of Pavetta, the granddaughter of Calanthe, the great-great-granddaughter of Rhiannon, was Lara Doran's true descendant. Vilgefortz learned about it, probably by accident. It is also known about by Enir Var Emrys, the Emperor of Nilfgaard.
And you know about it?
I know more about it than the two of them. But that means nothing. The mill of destiny is turning. The querns of fate are grinding. Whatever is destined must occur.
So, what must occur?
Whatever is destined to. That which was determined above in the metaphorical sense, of course. Something that is determined by the action of an unerringly functioning mechanism, at the root of which lies the purpose, the plan, and the result.
That's either poetry or metaphysics, or the one and the other, for they are occasionally difficult to distinguish. Are any hard facts possible, if only a very few? I'd love to discuss this and that with you, but it so happens I'm in a hurry.
Avalach gave him a long look. And where are you hurrying to? Forgive me. You, so it seems to me, haven't understood anything I've said to you. So I'll tell you straight. Your great rescue expedition is meaningless. It has lost all meaning. There are several reasons, the elf continued, looking at the witch's granite-like face. Firstly, it's too late now. The serious evil has already occurred. You're no longer in a position to save the girl from it. Secondly, now that she has taken the right road, the swallow will cope wonderfully by herself. She carries too mighty a force inside her to fear anything. She doesn't need your help. And thirdly...
I'm all ears, Avalach. All ears.
Thirdly, someone else will help her now. You can't be so arrogant as to think that the girl's destiny is exclusively bound to you.
Is that all?
Yes.
Then farewell.
Wait.
I said I'm in a hurry.
Let's suppose for a moment, the elf said serenely, that I know what will happen, that I can see the future. What if I tell you what is to happen, what will happen anyway, irrespective of the efforts you make, of the initiatives already undertaken? What if I told you that you could search for a peaceful place on Earth and stay there, doing nothing, waiting for the inevitable consequences of the course of events? Would you choose to do something like that?
No.
What if I communicated to you that your activities, testifying to your lack of faith in the unwavering mechanisms of the purpose, plan, and result, may, though the likelihood is slight, indeed change something, but only for the worse?
Would you reconsider?
Oh, I see from your expression that you wouldn't. Then I'll simply ask you, why not?
Do you really want to know?
I do.
Because I don't believe in your metaphysical platitudes about goals, plans, and preordained ideas of creators. Nor do I believe in the celebrated prophecy of Aethlena or other prophecies. I consider them, if you can imagine it, the same bullshit and humbug as your cave painting. The purple bison, Avalach. Nothing more. I don't know if you can't or won't help me. Nonetheless, I don't feel resentment towards you.
You say I can't or don't want to help you. And how might I help?
Geralt pondered for a moment, absolutely aware that much depended on how the question was put.
Will I get Ciri back?
The answer was immediate.
You will, only to lose her at once. And, to be clear, forever, irrevocably. Before it comes to that, you will lose everybody who accompanies you. You will lose one of your companions in the next few weeks, perhaps even days, perhaps even hours.
Thank you.
I haven't finished yet. The direct effect of your interference in the grinding querns of the purpose and the plan will be the death of tens of thousands of people. Which, as a matter of fact, doesn't matter much, since soon after, tens of millions of people will lose their lives. The world, as you know it, will simply vanish, cease to exist, in order, after a suitable time has passed, to revive in a totally different form. But in fact, no one has, nor will have, any influence on it. No one is capable of preventing it, nor staving off the course of events. Not you, not I, not sorcerers nor sages, not even Ciri. What do you say to that?
Purple bison. All the same, I thank you, Avalach.
While we are about it, the elf shrugged, I'm somewhat curious as to what a pebble falling in the gears of the querns might accomplish. May I do anything else for you?
Not really, because you can't show me Ciri, I imagine.
Who said so?
Geralt held his breath. Avalach headed towards the cave wall with rapid steps, indicating the Witcher to follow him.
The walls of Tir na Bea Arainn,
he pointed to the sparkling rock crystals,
have special qualities, and I, though I say it as shouldn't, have special abilities. Place your hands on this. Fix your gaze on it. Think intensively about how much she needs you right now, and declare, so to speak, the mental willingness to help. Think about how you want to run and rescue her, be beside her, something like that. The image should appear by itself and be distinct. Look, but refrain from impulsive reactions. Say nothing. It will be a vision, not communication. He obeyed. The first images, in spite of the promise, weren't distinct. They were vague, but so brutal that he stepped back involuntarily. A severed hand on a table, blood splashed on a glazed surface, skeletons on skeleton horses, Yennefer in manacles. A tower? A black tower. And behind it, in the background, the northern lights? And suddenly, without warning, the image became all too clear. Dandelion, Geralt yelled. Milva, Angolem. Eh? Avalach took an interest. Ah, yes, you seem to have spoiled everything. Geralt leapt back from the cave wall, almost falling over on a basalt plinth.
It doesn't bloody matter, he cried. Listen, Avalach, I must get to that druidic forest as quickly as possible.
Caid Mirkvid?
Very likely. My companions are in mortal danger there. They're fighting for their lives. Other people are also in danger. What's the quickest way? Oh, damn it. I'm going back for my sword and horse.
No horse, the elf calmly interrupted, is capable of carrying you to the Mirkvid before nightfall. But I haven't finished yet. Go and get your legendary sword, and meanwhile I'll find you a mount. A perfect steed for mountain tracks. It's a somewhat unusual one, I'd say, but with its help, you'll be in Caid Mirkvid in less than half an hour.
The knocker reeked like a horse, but that was where the similarity ended. Geralt had once seen in Mahakam a mountain goat-riding contest organized by dwarves, which had seemed to be a totally reckless sport. But it was only now as he sat on the back of the knocker, as it hurtled insanely up the cliff, that he learned what true recklessness was. In order not to fall off, he dug his fingers tightly into the rough, shaggy coat and squeezed his thighs against the monster's fleecy sides. The knocker stank of sweat, urine and vodka. It flew as though possessed, the earth thudding under the impact of its gigantic feet as though its soles were of bronze. Slowing slightly, it climbed up hillsides and pelted down them so fast the wind howled in Geralt's ears. It rushed across ridges, mountain paths and ledges so narrow Geralt kept his eyes tightly closed so as not to look down. It cleared waterfalls, cascades, chasms and clefts too extreme even for a mountain goat, and each successful leap was accompanied by a savage and deafening roar. That is, more savage and deafening than the knocker's usual roar, which was something it did almost constantly.
Don't race like that!
The rush of air shoved the words back down his throat.
Why not? You've been drinking.
They raced on. The wind whistled in his ears. The knocker reeked. The clatter of immense feet on rock fell silent. Instead, rock fields and scree rattled. Then the ground became less rocky, and something that might have been a dwarf pine flashed by. Then a blur of green and brown, for the knocker was loping in insane bounds through a fir forest. The scent of resin mingled with the monster's stench. The firs ceased and fallen leaves whispered, now red, now claret, ochre and golden.
Slow down!
The knocker cleared a pile of fallen trees with a huge bound. Geralt almost bit his tongue off. The breakneck ride ended as unceremoniously as it had begun. The knocker dug its heels into the ground, roared, and tossed the Witcher onto the leaf-strewn forest floor. Geralt lay still for a while and couldn't even curse from lack of breath. Then he stood up, hissing and rubbing his knee, which had begun to throb again.
You never fell off,
the knocker stated, with surprise in its voice.
Well, well.
Geralt didn't comment.
We've arrived.
The knocker pointed with one shaggy paw.
That's Caid Mirkvid.
Beneath them was a basin densely filled with mist. The tops of great trees showed through the haze.
That fog,
The knocker anticipated the question, sniffing.
Isn't natural. What's more, I can smell smoke from over there. If I were you, I'd hurry. Yeah, I'd go with you. I'm sick with a desire to fight. And I dreamed as a child of one day charging at people with a witcher on me back. But Avalach forbade me from showing myself. It's to do with the safety of our whole tribe. I know. Don't bear a grudge that I smacked you in the mouth. I don't. You're all right for a human.
Thank you. For the lift, too. The knocker bared his teeth among his red beard and breathed vodka.
Pleasure's all mine.
The fog lying on Mirkvid Forest was dense and had an irregular shape, calling to mind a heap of whipped cream squeezed onto a cake by a lunatic cook. The fog reminded the Witcher of Brokilon. The forest of the Dryads was often covered by a similarly dense, protective and camouflaging magical haze. Like Brokilon, it had the dignified and menacing atmosphere of an ancient forest, here at the edge consisting predominantly of alder and beech. And, just like in Brokilon, right at the edge of the forest, on the leaf-strewn road, Geralt almost tripped over a corpse. The cruelly massacred people weren't druids or Nilfgaardians, and they certainly didn't belong to Nightingale and Skiru's Hussa. Before Geralt had even spied the outlines of wagons in the fog, he recalled that Regis had spoken of pilgrims. It appeared that for some, the pilgrimage had not ended happily. The stench of smoke and burning, unpleasant in the damp air, became more and more distinct and pointed the way. Soon after, the way was also indicated by voices, cries, and the discordant music of fiddles. Geralt made haste. A wagon stood on the rain-softened road. More bodies lay beside the wheels. One of the bandits was rummaging around the wagon, chucking objects and tackle onto the road. Another was holding the unharnessed horses, and a third was stripping a foxskin coat from a dead pilgrim. A fourth was sawing a fiddle with a bow, evidently found among the loot, and utterly failing to get even a single pure note from the instrument. The cacophony came in useful. It muffled Geralt's steps. The music broke off abruptly. The fiddle strings whined piercingly. The brigand slammed down onto the leaves and spattered them with blood. The one holding the horses didn't even manage to shout. The sail severed his windpipe. The third brigand didn't manage to jump down from the wagon. He fell, yelling with his femoral artery carved open. The last one even managed to draw his sword, but not to raise it. Geralt shook blood from the fuller with his thumb.
"Yes, boys," he said to the forest and the scent of smoke. "This was a stupid idea. You oughtn't have listened to Nightingale and Skiru. You should have stayed at home."
He soon came across further wagons and further victims. Druids in blood-stained white robes also lay among the numerous mutilated pilgrims. The smoke from the now close fire crawled low over the ground. This time, the brigands were more vigilant. He only managed to stalk one of them, who was occupied pulling cheap rings and bracelets from the bloody hands of a murdered woman. Geralt, without hesitation, slashed the bandit. The bandit roared, and then the remaining men, brigands mixed up with Nilfgaardians, attacked him, yelling. He dodged into the forest to the foot of the nearest tree so the trunk would protect his back. But before the brigands could run over, hooves thudded, and from the bushes and fog emerged a mighty horse draped in a caparison with a red and gold diagonal checkered pattern. The horse was carrying a rider clad in full armour, a snow-white cloak, and a helmet with a perforated pig-faced visor. Before the bandits could compose themselves, the knight was already breathing down their necks and carving every which way with his sword, and blood was gushing in fountains. It was a splendid sight. Geralt didn't have time to watch, however, having two on his hands himself, a brigand in a cherry-red jerkin and a black-uniformed Nilfgaardian. The brigand exposed himself as he lunged, so Geralt slashed him across the face, and the Nilfgaardian, seeing teeth flying, took to his heels and vanished into the fog. Geralt was almost trampled by the horse in the checkered caparison, now running and riderless. Without delaying, he leapt through the undergrowth towards cries, curses, and thudding. Three bandits had dragged the knight in the white cloak from the saddle and were trying to kill him. One of them, standing with legs astride, was smiting with a poleaxe. The second was striking with a sword, and the third, small and red-haired, was hopping beside them like a hare, seeking a chance and an unprotected place where he could stab with his bear spear. The knight, lying on his back, was yelling incomprehensibly from inside his helmet and deflecting the blows with a shield held in both hands. The shield sank lower with each blow. It was almost resting on his breastplate. There was no doubt. One or two more blows, and the knight's innards would burst through every slit in his armour. Geralt was in the thick of it in three bounds, slashing the hopping redhead with the bear spear across the nape and carving open the belly of the one with the poleaxe. The knight, agile in spite of his armour, whacked the third brigand in the knee with the shield rim and pummeled him thrice in the face as he lay on the ground until blood sprayed across his shield. He rose on his knees, fumbled among ferns in search of his sword, buzzing like a great iron-plated drone. He suddenly saw Geralt and froze.
"In whose hands am I?"
he trumpeted from deep within his helmet.
"In no one's. The men lying there are also my foes." "Aha!"
The knight tried to raise his visor, but the metal plate was bent and the mechanism had blocked.
"Upon my word, thank you 100-fold for your succour." "I thank you, for it was you who came to my aid." "Indeed? When?"
"He didn't see anything," thought Geralt. "He hadn't even noticed me through the holes in that iron pot."
"What is your name?"
the knight asked.
"Geralt, of Rivia." "Coat of arms?" "It is not the time," said knight, "for heraldry." "Upon my word, 'tis the truth, stout-hearted Sir Geralt."
Having found his sword, the knight stood up. His chipped shield, like the horse's caparison, was decorated with a gold and red diagonal checkered pattern, the letters A and H alternating in the fields.
"They are not my ancestral arms," he boomed in explanation. "They are the initials of my suzerain lady, Duchess Anna Henrietta. I'm called the Checkered Knight. I'm a knight-errant, and forbidden from revealing my name or arms. I have taken knightly vows. Upon my word, thanks again for the help, Sir Knight." "The pleasure's all mine."
One of the defeated bandits groaned and rustled in the leaves. The checkered knight leapt and pinned him to the ground with a mighty thrust. The brigand's arms and legs waved like a spider impaled on a pin.
"Let us hurry," the knight said. "The rabble is still raging here. Upon my word, it's not time to repose yet."
"True," Geralt agreed. "There's a gang marauding through the forest, killing pilgrims and druids. My friends are in a predicament.
Excuse me for a moment."
A second brigand was showing signs of life. He was also vigorously pinned, and his turned-up feet cut such a caper that his boots fell off.
"Upon my word!"
The checkered knight wiped his sword on the moss.
"These good-for-nothings are loath to depart this life. Let it not astound you, Sir Knight, that I'm finishing off wounded. Upon my word, I've not done it for many years. But these imps recover so swiftly, an honest fellow may only envy them. Ever since I happened to cross swords with the same rascal thrice in a row, I began to finish them off more meticulously, once and for all."
"I understand."
"I, you see, am errant, but not, upon my word, erratic. Oh, it's my horse. Come here, Bucephalus."
The forest became more open and brighter. Great oaks with spreading but thin crowns began to predominate. They could now smell the smoke and stench of the fire nearby, and a moment later they could see it. Three cottages with thatched roofs, an entire small settlement, were on fire. The tarpaulins of the nearby wagons were also on fire. Corpses were lying between the wagons. From a distance, it was evident that many were wearing white druidic gowns. The bandits and Nilfgaardians, drumming up courage by yelling and concealed behind wagons they were pushing in front of them, were attacking a large house on stilts, leaning against the trunk of a gigantic oak. The house was built from robust beams, with a shingle roof down which the torches thrown by the bandits were harmlessly rolling. The besieged house was defending itself and striking back effectively. Before Geralt's eyes, one of the brigands leaned imprudently out from behind a wagon and fell as though struck by lightning with an arrow in his skull.
"Your friends," the checkered knight displayed his acuity, "must be in that building. Upon my word, they're in desperate straits. Onward, let us hasten to their aid."
Geralt heard screeching yells and orders and recognized the robber Nightingale with his bandaged cheek. He also glimpsed the half-elf Skiru hiding behind some Nilfgaardians in black cloaks. Suddenly, horns roared, so loudly that leaves fell from the oak trees. The hooves of war horses rumbled and the swords and armour of charging knights flashed. The robbers fled, yelling in all directions.
"Upon my word!" the checkered knight roared, spurring on his horse. "It's my comrades! They're ahead of us! Attack, so a little glory will be left for us! Smite! Kill!"
Galloping ahead on Bucephalus, the checkered knight fell on the fleeing robbers, hacked down two in a flash, and scattered the rest like a hawk among sparrows. Two of them turned towards Geralt, and the witcher dealt with them in the blink of an eye. A third shot at him with a Gabriel. A certain Gabriel, a craftsman from Verden, had invented and patented a miniature crossbow. He advertised them with the slogan, "Defend yourself!" His handbill declared, "Banditry and violence are rampant among us. The law is powerless and inept. Defend yourself. Don't leave home without a handy Gabriel crossbow. A Gabriel is your guardian. A Gabriel will protect you and your dear ones from bandits." Sales were phenomenal. Soon, every bandit packed a Gabriel during robberies. Geralt was a witcher and could dodge a bolt, but he'd forgotten about his painful knee. His evasive manoeuvre was an inch late, and the leaf-shaped point gashed his ear. The pain blinded him, but just for a moment. The brigand was too slow to reload and defend himself. The furious witcher slashed him across the hands, and then disemboweled him with a sweeping flourish of his scythe. Geralt hadn't even managed to wipe the blood from his ear and neck when he was attacked by a small character as agile as a weasel, with unnaturally shining eyes, armed with a curved Zerikanian sabre, which he was twirling with admirable skill. He parried two of Geralt's blows, and the fine steel of the two blades rang and showered sparks. The weasel was alert and keen-eyed. He noticed at once that the witcher was limping. He immediately began to circle and attack from a more favourable position. He was astonishingly quick. The sabre's blade seemed to wail as he made dangerous diagonal thrusts. Geralt was finding it more and more difficult to avoid the blows. He was limping worse and worse, forced to stand on his aching leg. The weasel suddenly hunched forward, jumped, and made a dexterous feint and lunge, slashing diagonally downwards. Geralt parried obliquely and deflected. The bandit spun nimbly, moving from his stance to a nasty cut from below, when he suddenly goggled, sneezed loudly, and covered himself in snot, dropping his guard for a moment. The witcher jabbed him fast in the neck, and the blade went in as far as the vertebrae.
"Well, who'll tell me now?" he panted, looking at the twitching corpse, "that taking drugs isn't bad for your health."
A bandit attacking him with a raised club tripped and fell face down in the mud, an arrow sticking out of the back of his head.
"I'm coming, witcher!" Milva screamed. "I'm coming! Hold on!"
Geralt turned, but there was no one left to hack. Milva had shot the only brigand remaining in the vicinity. The rest fled into the forest, pursued by the colourful knighthood. Several were being tormented by the checkered knight on Bucephalus. He caught them, and his terrible raging could be heard from the forest. One of the black-uniformed Nilfgaardians, not finished off precisely, suddenly leapt to his feet and bolted. Milva raised and tautened her bow in a second. The fletchings howled, and the Nilfgaardian fell on the leaves with a grey-feathered arrow between his shoulder blades. The archer sighed heavily.
"We'll hang for this," she said.
"Why do you think so?"
"This is Nilfgaard, isn't it? And it's the second month I've been mainly shooting at Nilfgaardians."
"This is Toussaint, not Nilfgaard."
Geralt felt the side of his head and took away a bloody hand.
"Damn it. What is it? Have a look, Milva."
The archer examined it carefully and critically.
"Your ear's been torn off," she finally said. "Nothing to worry about."
"Easy for you to say. I was fond of that ear. Help me to bind it with something. It's dripping down my collar. Where are Dandelion and Angoulême?"
"In the cottage with the pilgrims. Oh, a pox on it."
Hooves pounded, and from the mist emerged three riders on war horses, cloaks and pennons fluttering as they galloped. Before their war cries resounded, Geralt had grabbed Milva by the arm and pulled her under a wagon. There was no fooling around with someone charging with a lance, which gave the riders an effective range of 10 feet in front of their horse's head.
"Get out!"
The knight's mounts churned the earth around the wagon with their horseshoes.
"Drop your weapons and get out."
"We're going to hang," Milva murmured.
She might have been right.
"Ha! Thugs!"
One of the knights, bearing a shield with a black bull's head on a silver field, roared.
"Ha! Rogues! 'Pon my word you shall hang!"
"'Pon my word," crowed the other, with a uniformly blue shield, in a youthful voice. "We'll carve them up on the spot."
"Hi, I say, stop."
The checkered knight emerged from the fog on Bucephalus. He had finally managed to lift his twisted visor, from beneath which luxuriant flaxen moustaches now peeped.
"Free them with all haste," he called. "They are not bandits, but upright and honest folk. The lady manfully acted in defence of the pilgrims, and that fellow is a goodly knight."
"A goodly knight?"
Bull's head raised his visor and scrutinised Geralt extremely incredulously.
"'Pon my word, it cannot be. 'Pon my word,"
the checkered knight thumped an armoured fist into his breastplate.
"It can, I give my word. This doughty fellow saved my life when I was in need, after I was flung to the ground by ne'er-do-wells. He is called Geralt of Rivia."
"Arms?"
"I'm forbidden from revealing them," the witcher grunted. "I can share neither my true name nor my arms. I have taken knightly vows. I am the errant, Geralt."
"Ooh!"
A familiar, insolent voice suddenly yelled.
"Look what the cat dragged in! Ha! I told you, Auntie, that the witcher would come and rescue us."
"And just in time," shouted Dandelion, approaching with Angoulême and a small group of terrified pilgrims.
He was carrying his lute and the ever-present tube of scrolls.
"And not a second too soon. You have a fine sense of drama, Geralt. You ought to write plays for the stage."
He suddenly fell silent. Bull's head leaned over in his saddle, and his eyes shone.
"Viscount Julian? Baron de Peyrac-Peyran?"
Two more knights emerged from behind the oaks, one in a great helm adorned with a very good likeness of a white swan with outstretched wings, was leading two prisoners in a lasso. The other knight, errant but practical, was preparing a noose and looking for a suitable bow.
"Neither Nightingale,"
Angoulême noticed the witch's expression,
"nor Skiru. Pity."
"Pity," Geralt admitted, "but we'll try to correct that. Sir Knight."
But Bull's Head, or rather Baron de Peyrac-Peyran, wasn't paying any attention to him. He only had eyes, it seemed, for Dandelion.
"'Pon my word," he drawled. "My eyes do not deceive me. It's Viscount Julian in person. Ha! The Duchess will be pleased."
"Who is Viscount Julian?"
the witcher asked curiously.
"That would be me," Dandelion muttered. "Don't interfere, Geralt."
"Lady Henrietta will be pleased," Baron de Peyrac-Peyran repeated. "Ha! 'Pon my word! We shall take you all to Beauclerc Castle. But no excuses, Viscount. I won't hear of any excuse."
"Some of the brigands fled."
Geralt spoke in quite a cool tone.
"I suggest we catch them first, and then think about what to do with this day. So, interestingly begun. What say you, Baron?"
"'Pon my word," said Bull's Head. "Nothing will come of it. Pursuit is impossible. The criminals fled across the stream, and we mustn't put a foot over it, not even a scrap of hoof. That part of the Mirkvid Forest is an inviolable sanctuary, in accordance with the compacts entered into with the Druids by Her Majesty Duchess Anna Henrietta, who benignly reigns over Toussaint."
"The robbers bolted in there, dammit,"
Geralt interrupted, growing furious. "They're going into that inviolable sanctuary to kill. And you're telling me about some compacts. We've given our knightly word." It seemed a mutton head would have suited Baron de Peyrac-Peyran's shield better than a bull's head.
"We are forbade. Compacts. Not a single step onto druidic territory."
"If they're forbidden, well, that's too bad,"
Angoulême snorted, pulling two bandit horses by their bridles.
"Drop that empty talk, witcher. Let's go." I still have unfinished business with Nightingale, and you, I think, would like to talk some more with the half-elf.
I'm with you, said Milva. I'll just find some mare or other.
Me too, Dandelion muttered. I'm with you too. Oh, no, 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 called the bull-headed baron. Upon my word, Viscount Julian will ride with us to Beauclerc Castle. The Duchess wouldn't forgive us if after meeting you we didn't bring you to her. I shan't stop the rest of you. You are free in your plans and ideas. As the companions of Viscount Julian, Her Grace, Lady Henrietta, would have gladly received you with all due respect and invited you to stay at the castle. But why, if you scorn her hospitality...
We scorn it not,
Geralt interrupted with a menacing glance, restraining Angoulême, who was making insulting gestures with her hand behind the baron's back.
Far be it from us to scorn it. We shall not fail to pay our respects and due homage to the Duchess. But first, we will accomplish what we must accomplish. We also gave our word. One might say that we've also made compacts. Once we have carried them out, we shall make for Beauclerc Castle. We shall unfailingly go there. If only, he added knowingly and with emphasis, to ensure that no disgrace or dishonour befalls our comrade, Dandelion.
I meant Julian, by thunder. Upon my word,
the Baron suddenly laughed.
No disgrace nor dishonour will befall Viscount Julian. I'm prepared to give my word on it. For I omitted to tell you, Viscount, that Duke Raymond died of apoplexy 2 years past. Ha ha!
Dandelion shouted, beaming all over.
The Duke kicked the bucket? Oh, these are truly marvellous and joyous tidings. I mean, I meant to say, sorrow and grief, a great loss. May the earth lie lightly on him. If that is the case, let's ride with all haste to Beauclerc, noble knights. Geralt, Milva, and Angoulême, I'll see you in the castle.
They forded the stream and spurred the horses into the forest among spreading oaks and stirrup-high ferns. Milva found the trail of the fleeing gang without difficulty. They rode as quickly as they could, for Geralt feared for the druids. He was afraid the survivors of the gang, feeling safe, would want to seek vengeance on the druids for the massacre sustained from the knight's errand of Toussaint.
Well, Dandelion's come up trumps, Angoulême suddenly said. When Nightingale's men surrounded us in that cottage, he told me what he feared in Toussaint.
I guessed, the witcher replied. I just didn't know he'd aim so high. The Duchess, oh.
It was a good few years ago, and Duke Raymond, the one who croaked, had apparently sworn he'd tear out the poet's heart, have it roasted, and make his inconstant Duchess eat it for supper. Dandelion's lucky he didn't fall into the Duke's clutches while he was still alive. We're also lucky.
That remains to be seen.
Dandelion claims that Duchess Henrietta is madly in love with him.
Dandelion always claims that.
Shut your traps, Milva snapped,
reining in her horse and reaching for her bow. A brigand rushed blindly towards them without a hat, weaving from oak to oak. He was running, falling over, getting up and running again, and screaming. Shrilly, dreadfully, awfully.
What the?
Angoulême asked in astonishment. Milva tautened her bow in silence. She didn't shoot, but waited until the brigand approached and rushed straight for them, as though he couldn't see them. He ran between the horses of the witcher and Angoulême. They saw his face, as white as a sheet and contorted in horror. They saw his bulging eyes.
What the?
Angoulême repeated. Milva, recovered from her astonishment, turned in the saddle and sent an arrow into the fleeing man's back. The brigand roared and tumbled into the ferns. The earth shook, making acorns fall from a nearby oak.
I wonder, said Angoulême, what he was fleeing from.
The earth shook again. The bushes rustled and broken branches cracked.
What is it?
Milva stammered, standing up in her stirrups.
What is it, witcher?
Geralt looked, saw it and sighed loudly. Angoulême also saw it and paled.
Oh, fuck!
Milva's horse also saw it. It neighed wildly, reared, and then bucked. The archer flew from the saddle and sprawled heavily onto the ground. The horse raced into the forest. Without a second thought, the witcher's steed rushed after it, unfortunately choosing a path under an overhanging oak branch. The branch toppled the witcher from the saddle. The impact and the pain in his knee almost made him lose consciousness. Angoulême managed to stay in control of her frenzied horse the longest, but finally she too ended up on the ground, and her horse fled, almost trampling Milva as she was getting up. And they saw more clearly the thing that was coming for them, and absolutely, absolutely lost their astonishment at the animal's panic. The creature resembled a gigantic tree, a branching ancient oak. Perhaps it was an oak, but if so, it was a very unusual oak. Instead of standing somewhere in a clearing among fallen leaves and acorns, instead of letting squirrels scamper over it and linnets shit on it, this oak was marching briskly through the forest, stamping its sturdy roots steadily and waving its boughs. The stout trunk, or torso, of the monster had a diameter of more or less 4 yards, and the hollow gaping in it was probably not a hollow, but its maw, for it was snapping with a sound like the slamming of a heavy door. Though the ground trembled beneath its terrible weight, making it difficult for them to keep their balance, the creature was